Hello and welcome everyone to our next podcast, next TMS podcast. Today we will be discussing section 3.3 from the TMS recovery program recently donated to the online community by Alan CSW. So the recovery program can be found, if you just Google Alan Gordon TMS recovery program, it'll pop right up. It's the first search result, but it's divided into two parts. The first part is kind of classic psychoeducational TMS healing, you know, about accepting the diagnosis and how that's crucially important. And then it's talking about, he calls it reframe the meaning of the pain, to recognize that it isn't just the pain that distracts you, it's also the fear of the pain and the crucial role that fear plays in helping you overcome that. And then the third step in part one is working towards outcome independence. We've all seen a million times on the forum people who are obsessed with how quickly they are healing, and that obsession serves to perpetuate their TMS, certainly good for no one. So that's part one. And then in part two, it gets into a little bit deeper work. And he says at the beginning of part two, this is what Alan says, the underlying message of part two can be summed up in four words, be nice to yourself. And what he's found in his practice and also through his own experience of being a TMSer himself, that TMSers often aren't nice to themselves. Some of them are, some of them aren't. And so these are the techniques which he advises to help you be nice to yourself. Step one is generate self-compassion. If you don't have compassion for yourself, then why would you be nice to yourself? It takes a lot of psychic energy to change those old habits. And the key to generating that and to getting yourself to change is to generate self-compassion. Then you recognize destructive behaviors. That's what we went over last week. Some destructive behaviors are about self-criticism, pressure, and fear. You're always criticizing yourself, you're putting pressure on yourself, and you are causing yourself to be afraid. There are, in addition, after this, there are 9 more steps, but we're going through them one by one. Today we're going to talk about identify the source of the abuse. Bruce, do you want to take it away?
Well, you pretty much summarized everything up to this point, Rob. Forrest, excuse me for blowing your cover. But this is the point of identifying the source of the abuse that's making you hard on yourself. That's what this section covers. And Alan looks into the source of these abusive habits, where they come from. And he says that these old emotionally repressive coping styles that we generate, to use my own words, are based on messages that we formulated when we were younger. And he doesn't say it here explicitly, but this is, of course, when your parents were bigger than you were, and you were thinking realistically in terms of the way you were when you were 6. But unfortunately, many people continue to think like they're 6 on until they're 30, 40, 50, so on. It gets back to that question that Michael Brown asks in the presence process. When are you going to really grow up? Really? And it seems as though Alan thinks that it's a good idea to do some psychoarchaeology and figure out what these things are that's leading to this, albeit self-destructive behavior, not just self-critical behavior, not just abusive behavior, but it ends in self-destruction, which is what I think the message that, have I been cut off?
No, you're still there.
Oh, well, anyway, Alan lists a number of situations that can that occurred possibly when you were younger that leads to this self-abusive behavior. And he says maybe your mom made you feel bad about yourself. Maybe your dad got excited when you got good grades and was bummed out when you didn't. I think that's what they call qualified love and qualified acceptance. I'll only love you and treat you like a person if you get straight A's in school. Otherwise, personally, and I'm sure that's a kind of enraging thing for a young person to have laid on them. And Alan goes on to list some of the other sources. Maybe your grandmother ignored you as a form of punishment. Maybe your dad had epilepsy and unintentionally terrified you each time he had a seizure. Maybe you had an older brother who got all the attention. Maybe your mom was depressed and you were preoccupied with making her feel better. Maybe your dad was irrationally anxious and you never felt completely safe. Maybe you were one of 11 kids and you made yourself invisible because you saw how overwhelmed your parents were. Or maybe your home life was relatively drama-free, but you got bullied in seventh grade. I remember all of us budding intellectuals in the neighborhood were bullied in seventh grade when we had to ride the bus with the bullies over to intermediate school. But you tend to hunker down and get tight with your brothers then when you're subjected to this sort of thing. Anyway, I think that lists pretty much all of the scenarios that Alan lists here, but I'm sure we can come up with many, many more that lead toward immature behavior, emotional behavior patterns in adulthood.
Just to be clarifying, now, do you mean people acting immaturely or replicating patterns that started when they were young?
Well, those patterns that are replicated when they were young are by necessity sui generis immature. And you get lockstep into that.
We got a big word alert, though. If you're going to drop sui generis, you're going to have to explain it, though.
by its own nature.
It's, I see.
Yeah. Intrinsic.
Thanks, Bruce.
I guess. Well, it's good to pop a little Latin in there once in a while.
There you go.
Just to so we recognize our roots.
There you go.
But Alan thinks that all these abusive behavior patterns that grow from childhood experiences are the things that fuel the inner bully. And I think last week I said this is the point at which psychoarchaeology forms a nexus with Monty's
the present-based
admission
stuff.
to be in the clean room,
to think clean,
to deal with these forces, but without dwelling on their origins so much. And we came up with the idea, I think, at the end that some people have to go through this psychoarchaeology to open the door into the clean room, and some can go right into the clean room. The ones who get it with the book cure, for example, they get it. They're the ones who get it right away. But sometimes people have to go back and find the sources of their anger and their immature behavior, and they find that helpful in terms of moving to the next step of actually doing the self-therapy that is encapsulated in their recovery process. They're ready to, it's almost like a neurotic who has to tap so many times on the wall before he can go down and eat breakfast. And he does that all the time over and over again. But you can see where it can become a dead end, where you keep engaging in psychoarchaeology until it actually reinforces the neural pathways, the pain pathways, without forming other alternative routes.
What do other people think about that? Like, so psychoarchaeology is a term that Steve Ozanich either came up with or popularized. It's an awesome term. What's the role of psychoarchaeology? How much do we need to go into the past? So once you get to the roots of the abuse, what do you do next?
Well, also,
what do you do with that?
Also, for us, whether it reinforces the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, rather, I saw that film by Howard Schubner where he's talking about how the old pain pathways are programmed, and part of the therapeutic process that he performs allows the patient to activate alternate pain-free pathways, because he says there are infinite number of other neural pathways that could be used, and if you keep reenacting those old memories, you just keep the
You make it worse. So if let's make it concrete, because I worry that the two of us we tend to get kind of abstract and you know, analytical. But let's just say that suppose you were made afraid when you were young. If you start going over those scary experiences more and more, could you possibly re-traumatize yourself? Could you become more anxious, more nervous? Tend to catastrophize more by going over that old stuff. Did I get that right?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking last night as I went to bed, the difference between processing and dissipating. Is there a difference?
Yes.
You can process those memories and change them onto a higher plane.
Right.
Or you can dissipate them just by feeling them intensely and letting them work themselves out, like you do in ISTP-DP, those kind of therapeutic strategies. I don't know. Whatever
let's
works.
Let's get someone else involved. Anyone else want to jump in? Like, how much do you emphasize the childhood stuff? What have people found helpful in their own lives and in terms of what they've read about on the forum? Like, do we go deep into the past? How deep? How long do you stay in the past?
Well, for me, I remember about 12, 13 years ago, I was called to be a preacher. And at that time, I had been really shy of really talking to people or getting up in front of people or anything my whole life. And really, in my mind, I mean, I was that way ever since I was a 6-year-old kid. I remember last week when we was talking, you had asked me when did I start this, really wanting to help people and all that. And it started back when I was 6 years old. My mother used to say all the time that she was hurting and everybody was getting on her nerves. And, you know, she wished certain things on herself. And I wanted to help my mother. And I don't know where the shyness came from, but it stayed on me all the way till I was like 29 years old. And when we think about the past, I think, you know, why didn't it ever leave me as I was growing up? I know that's type of people's personalities, but it's also the inner bully that was every time I would start to speak to somebody, my mind would say, you know, you're going to mess up. Do something wrong, and that's the part that always made me shy away from being able to do what I wanted to do, to be that overcomer, you know, to be the more than a conqueror, as you know, as the word says. And what happened when I finally did get up and start speaking in front of people and big crowds and everything, it let up. And at that time, I went for nearly 10 years with just about a level 2 pain, where it was always a level 10 pain before that. Now, I took it as I was healed at that time. It came back on me 2 years ago. But, you know, that inner bully or that shyness, whatever we call it, it started when I was 6 years old, or that I remember.
Well, it seems like the inner bully was telling you, Herbie, that you weren't good enough.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So it gets back to self-esteem, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So much of it does, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wanted to help.
It's interesting.
So
now you said that it sounds like you made a lot of progress in terms of like public speaking. Did you do much psychoarchaeology to do that, or did you just go out and do the public speaking?
No, at that time when I was 29 years old to 35, I was a preacher in a church. Now, from 15 to 29, all I did was study psychology. Just about everything you could imagine. I was trying to find myself. I was trying to find out how come was I so recluse? How come was I hurting? How come was I in pain all those years from the age of 15 till, you know, 29 when I started speaking? The pain let up so much that I actually said I wasn't in pain at that time, which I still was. But it lit up so much, it amazed me. But I didn't make the connection that because I was basically taking over the inner bully and standing up for myself, and I didn't make that connection. I was looking at it like I was healed of from, you know, laying on hands, being in the church. But now I know that it was standing up to the inner bully.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't doubt miracles, though, you know, but at the same time, I know from Sarno's book and all the studies what had happened. I brought it to myself through my own standing up to the inner bully.
Yeah, because it you know, there are different approaches, and what I hear is rather than doing psychoarchaeology, you effectively used a what I might call a behavioral approach. You changed your behavior. You got up in front of the people. You faced your fears and you conquered it. Much like many of us do with our pain, we're afraid of our pain, and we face it. We do the activity. We get better.
Yes.
We lose our fear.
It was amazing how much, like I said, when I got up and started doing that, and how much the pain released for a long time. It was just amazing.
That sounds like you engaged in personal empowerment.
Yes.
Which got you out of that low self-esteem cul-de-sac, that dead end.
Yes.
And it seems like there's many, many paths, there's many roads to Rome. Like we all, I think inside of us have a sense about what's going to work for us in terms of mastering whatever it is that we need to master. I'm really curious. We have a Tom, you're here today. Do you mind if I call you out and get your take on this? Because I tend to think of you as not being someone who pushes the heavy, heavy journaling, the heavy psychoarchaeology. And I think of you as being someone, what I've learned from you, I feel, is living in the moment and just enjoying life. Is that, do you want to tie that in? Do you want to say a couple words about that?
You were talking to me, Tom? Dennis Tom?
Yeah, I sure was, yep.
Okay, I thought so. Okay, I'm on Verizon, you know, so there's a lot of fog out here, and I'm on the water, so it interferes with Verizon signals. But, I was just thinking about that. What would I rather be doing? Sitting in the hot tub or swimming in the pool or... I think I've done my fair share of introspection or psychoarchaeology, and I don't know, I'm not coming up with anything new and exciting. I think I'd rather, at this point, look for good things in my past that were good, and overall, I'm happy with my life. I'm 65, and I feel okay. I feel pretty good, and looking forward to maybe the oldest tennis player I knew. He was playing tennis when he was 102 years old. Fella Ken Beer. Yeah, and I met him when he was 98 years old, playing in a tournament in Monterey, Carmel. And I think it's worthy of a story. A lot of TMS, according to Steve-O, is due to fear of aging and what's going to happen to us when we get old. I'm what they call a senior tennis player, and it goes in age groups, five-year increments. And my mentors, heroes, are guys like Ken Beer, who 102 is still hitting tennis balls, and at 98 playing tournaments. And a little story. I bumped into him down there at Carmel, Monterey, in the middle of summer, I think it was July, at a tennis tournament. And he was with his wife, who had Alzheimer's. And he parked the car near the court with the door open so his wife could watch him play tennis. And then after a match, he won his match. He had to play down to guys in the 80s because there's no one in the 95s play. So he won his match, and he had to stick around. So he goes up to the tournament director and says, "Look, I'm a little hard of hearing." You know, he's 98. I got Motel 6 on the line here up in Santa Cruz. I can't hear him. We need a room for tonight so I can play. I mean, this guy at 98 is driving with his wife, his Alzheimer, playing tennis tournaments, and he's in Monterey in the middle of summer with no room reservation. And sure enough, he got a room. To me, that is the utmost courage. That's my hero, Ken Beer. Can you imagine that? So, yeah, I could not believe it. Driving at that age, no room, middle of summer, on the California coast. So that's what I hope to achieve in life, I think. there's another quick story. My other mentor, hero, Alex Swetka, who just recently passed away. He's the world champion, number one in the world at 95. I had dinner with that man and his wife a couple years ago. He was driving a very big motor home down in at a tennis tournament in Palm Springs, and he drives all over the country. And he was almost, I guess, 93, very lucent. And he ran out of age group tournaments. The tennis thing cuts off at 90. And he was 95. He ran out of age groups, and he was petitioning the USTA to come up with a 95 age group bracket, and then he passed away. And I think maybe he passed away because he ran out of age group tournaments. So he's another one of my heroes. So life doesn't end at 65. It might be just beginning, and therefore I don't really fear this aging thing, which is a huge fear, apparently, for a lot of people subconsciously as a big TMS, cause of TMS. And I see it in a lot of people's posts.
Yeah.
So those are my
stories. It
seems
like the whole goal of TMS is essentially to pull you away from your experience, to pull yourself away from life. And, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is that it's important to bring yourself back to life, to enjoy life, to not let any of it stop you. And I think it's relevant to people who are still in a lot of pain as well. You know, they're like that 98-year-old guy who, you know, they're in a lot of pain, but the key is having that same courage to not let it stop you, to not be afraid of it, and to just keep on going stubbornly. It seems like when I watch the people who succeed, speed. It's that happiness and that joy, that in that kind of indomitable spirit, which seems to help people an awful lot.
You know, that was on news today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was on news. There was 400,000 people studied at the age of 65 or something, and something about dementia. And the ones that kept moving and kept going, to where they might get it, the 3% that were getting it, the ones that kept moving and kept going after retirement and didn't just sit down and, you know, and just take it easy, the ones that kept moving and kept their life, you know, with things to do, and they made it almost, they were a group with no dementia. It their life was still going strong for years and years and years,
yeah,
which
I
has common sense.
I knew a professor at the University of Denver who, Hal Priest, Harvard class of 1920, and he was still teaching advanced classes in Renaissance epic, like Tasso and Ariosto and Milton and so on, when he was 90. And he came in every morning impeccably dressed with a Homburg and a long coat, even when it was 10 below out.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught these 8 o'clock classes, but he was the one who would flunk anybody if they were on his committee. If he was on your committee, you were going to fail your orals, because he knew everything from 1920 to the present and had memorized. There was not a book, canon, he did not know almost word for word. So anything you would say, he could refute it right now. And he was into the old school of testing, where he tested you for, like, oh, the 13 original Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
So it sounds like he was incredibly sharp.
Sharp and witty. And it's because he remained engaged. He'd been a bush pilot in Alaska, you know, to show the variety of things he'd been in.
Yeah.
And so this, well, I wonder how much of that has to do with the molecules of emotion, a la Candace Pert, whether keeping a high, what is it, serotonin level, keeps the programmed pain pathways from becoming full of pain. Rather, it keeps them active. So any kind of activity that you're engaged in actively like that, intellectually and physically, keeps the serotonin level high. And that overcomes a lot of these problems, including TMS, I think.
Wow.
I think that the parallels between that what we're talking about with the dementia study that Herbie mentioned seems like it's all the same thing, and that TMS, the pain, tends to narrow your life, and then I think it undermines your resiliency, because when I see people who are in a bad state with their TMS healing, they are afraid, they're terrified, and you just get the sense that the TMS has them in control. And then you see other people who also have terrible pain, but they're not afraid. And it's something about allowing, as Joy just wrote in the chat room, allowing courage to replace fear. I think it's an important thing, and still finding joy in your life. As Stock Trader wrote in the chat room, happiness first and TMS healing will naturally follow.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is so true. It's one of my favorite things. Happiness first, TMS healing will naturally follow. And that, just switching over the parallel again, that seems to be what this tennis player is doing. Happiness first, play the game, let your life be restricted, and the health will follow even when you're 98. So that's a good thing. Speaking of Stock Trader's contributions, he also wrote, "I only touch the past if my current thoughts and emotions take me back. Otherwise, I only stay on the present and let go of the past." I think there's a lot of wisdom in there. I think TMSers are so driven. When they're in the pain, they want to work so hard. And I feel like, I think that, you know, Alan is telling us to go to the roots and figure out what's there. And I think that, that we can find a lot of insight in the roots. But mostly, most of us aren't like Helen. It's not like there is some deep, old, heavily repressed rage, which is just bubbling up. You know, I think that you need to go to the past insight, but it's not somewhere that you want to take up residence. You don't want to live in the past. Because again, if you live in the past, that's exactly what the TMS wants you to do. The TMS wants to separate you from, you know, the gusto and the joy of living your life in the present. So I'd say that that's what the goal is to live in the present. And in some sense, to stop trying so hard, which is hard for us TMSers. We want to try hard.
That's right.
Yeah, I know I went through the journaling process 3 times, going over, childhood hurts, and then contemporary stresses, and then personality traits. I did it first in the SEP. I did it again in Howard Schubner's book. And before that, actually, I did it with the divided mind when I listed out those same things. And it seems like after doing that 3 times, you reach a point where, well, hasn't come an aha moment, and I'm going to be, and the pain is going to be wiped away when I find this one thing. Then you have a kind of realization that comes on, that you have to actually actively engage in the recovery process and do it inside yourself. You have to work with your mind. And that's what I think Monty means by thinking clean. Because after you've done all this stuff and you look around for an answer, you realize the answer is you. And you've got to make the change. And that's where the work really begins.
Well, or as, so I think Alan talks about the same thing. He talks about attend to your internal state. And whenever I hear think clean, I think of attending to your internal state. Have you been reading Monty recently? Did you go out and get the book?
No. No, I've watched all his talks, of course, in the media section.
They're pretty solid. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see what he's getting to, but it doesn't mean that some people don't benefit from taking that trip into the past and or feeling those emotions again, ISTPDP, after that fashion, reliving those past moments. But you realize that with the knowledge you've gained from doing that, that's all leading toward a point at which you get to ground zero and start working on yourself and changing your head, you know, and getting rid of the pain thereby. And all of that psychoarchaeology won't do that unless it leads up to that moment of awareness when you actually sit down, hunker down, and make the change.
So the psychoarchaeology is a tool by which you can make the change. It can help make the change, but in the end, it's you who's got to stand up to the inner bully. It's you who has to stop the repressive behaviors. It's you who has to attend to your internal state.
Well, it's like any task. Finally, it gets down to work, and there's no easy way around that. You know, whether you're writing code for a program, or whether you're going to build a bridge, or whether you're going to work on a car engine, or whether you're going to write a book, or whether you're going to really read a poem and understand it. It takes work. And all these other things, going back over childhood memories and personality traits, don't really do it. They give you a lot of insight,
yeah,
a lot of knowledge about yourself. But,
very valuable tools, yeah.
But you have to get to that point. where you sit down and do the work, which is not easy, by the way.
So what do you, now when you're describing this, what do you define as the work? What is the work? I think that's what our listeners are going to want to know.
Well, activating your mind in such a way that the TMS symptoms become redundant and are unnecessary. So you begin to feel enlightened or empowered or energized or full of self-confidence and no fear.
So you were bringing it back to self-esteem before, and I think that, that self-esteem is not just the problem, but it's also the solution.
Yes, I noticed that from reading, what is it, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. It's sitting over here with Gabor Mate. He talks about how addiction, how opiates, hard drugs, imitate endorphins and serve as a substitute for them. And it seems that endorphins get rid of pain, and perhaps all of this TMS gets back to a low level of endorphins, which is goes hand in hand with low self-esteem, with fear, things that have perhaps been engendered by some traumatic event that's questioned your self-confidence, like a death in the family or a divorce or loss of money. It really causes a biochemical change in those in that gray matter.
Yes, Stock Trader jumped.
Yeah.
There you go. I agree. Stock Trader jumped in about the work, and I'm going to see if anyone else wants to jump in, because I do like to rotate it. He said, TMS is a lifetime journey. We have to deal with everyday stressors, emotions, and thoughts. We tend to be predisposed. Everybody's different about this, but if we tend to be predisposed to TMS, we may have to do a lot of this. He goes on to say, we need to accept that there is no such thing as a TMS cure, as long as we have a mind and body. And I think that's very true. I think it's very true. Later on, he says, we could be pain-free, but TMS will live with us like an alarm, telling us that deep inside us, there's something which is not happy where we are. So Joy, we haven't heard from you yet today.
I've been listening.
It's been good. Now, I know that when you've talked about also this issue of how much do you go into the past versus how much do you use it as a tool.
I think it's a balance.
It's a balance. I think balance is the most important thing. I do want to say, the only reason that I'm saying all of this is I think that a lot of people, they read the Sarno books and they hear about repression. And they hear about the importance of childhood, and they learn about this psychodynamic approach, and then they say, okay, I got to go deep. And then I just see a lot of people on the forum who've been crying their eyes out, you know, with these tear-soaked journals for years, and I just feel bad, which is the only reason that I'm emphasizing the need for balance. But Alan did put, go and look at the childhood roots in the program, and I think he was wise to do so. So I think it really is about balance.
And moderation.
Yeah. Yeah, and learning and taking joy.
Also, I think having a vision.
Tell us about that.
To nurture your vision, affirm your vision. You know, goals, structure.
This is similar to what Bruce was saying about something to...
Take risks, grow.
Yeah. I think that Schubiner talks about that. Is that in the last stage of his book? Someone who knows Schubiner's work better than I do. He talks about kind of reinventing your life. Am I right?
Yeah, that's one of the meditations, too, that corresponds to a particular section of Unlearn Your Pain. That is one of the steps.
Excellent.
Well, you know, Steve Osinich has got, I think it's on page 72 in the Great Pain Deception, about how one of the main things is a relationship to be able to, or a lot of people that stay in pain is because they've been at home too long. They haven't been able to get out and join in with other people and be around other people. And I was just hitting on reading that today, and it stood out to me. And wow, I was like, you know, everybody knows now that, you know, Pops passed away not too long ago, and I was kind of catching myself, you know, being stuck in the house. And after I started, you know, I had to get out and go get my head out of the house, you know, and just getting out and going and walking and just enjoying nature, doing like Tennis Tom, getting out there, enjoying my life, getting out of the house. It started helping me heal better, you know.
It has really a lot of wisdom in there.
It's important.
Yeah, if I could join that, I agree. It's mind, body, and Dr. Sarno has made it into one word. When I write mind, body, it's one word now, as he did in the title of the of his book. I've often advised people that they need to get a minimum amount of body of exercise, and I often, people are in so much pain they can't do other things, I tell them go they can access a swimming pool and get in the water. Almost everyone can swim 30 minutes a minimum day of either a walk or a swim or some kind of aerobic exercise, bicycling, in order to give the mind just to clear out all the garbage out of the bloodstream and clear out the mind, or do headstands for 20 minutes or something.
Yeah.
You know, but get that blood going to the brain in order to do the work that might be the psychological work, and it just gives a positive feeling about it. Gives a confidence that you have the inner strength, the confidence to overcome things. Because during the day, you know, sometimes when you're dead tired at night, your thoughts start getting negative, and then you start realizing, well, in the morning or whatever, I feel better, I feel confident, and I feel I can take on the day. But then I get tired, and I start to, it is an absolute necessity, I think, to do some exercise in order to keep the mind healthy.
Because the mind body is an integrated whole. Like, one thing is connected to the other, and you got to get out there and get moving.
Yes. You know, if I can give one more anecdote, I was with a lady friend years ago, and we were staying at her mother's house, and she was, I'd say, about 85 again. And she was, you know, fairly infirm and, you know, let's say arthritic, and they had a pool in the backyard. And I saw her in the morning. She did her pool work, and I said, she looks like a fish. So if all else forms of activity fail, I think return to the water. That's where life came from, is the water. And when we get back in the water, gravity, we have the help of the water for movement. And there's all kinds of exercise people can do if they can't do it on land, if they can't run anymore or walk anymore or bicycle. Find a pool, there's so many of them, and do some water exercise.
That makes sense. Joy in the chat room, emotion is created by motion. I think that's beautiful.
Yes, that's awesome.
Yeah. I was watching recently, James Alexander has put up on YouTube 2 hours of video. It's rather long, of introduction that he does for his patients when he's doing EMDR with them. And it talks about how in dreams we process our emotions and we process our experiences. Feels like the same thing could happen with physical movement. You know, you get out there, you exercise your body, it just clears out some of the junk. Stock Trader mentioned the same thing. He says, staying physical is good. It slows the mental chatter. That is the problem. The mental chatter is killer. TMSers live in their heads too much. Mm-hmm. And get out there. And I see Bruce nodding your head.
Oh, yeah. I noticed just this last week I've been pushing myself harder than ever before. And one day I pushed myself harder because I did all these boulder problems and I ran into a friend and he wanted to climb. So I got on the walls when I was really tired. And when I came down, all of a sudden I was normal. And I realized I'd gone to another level biochemically than hugging, you know, staying inside my parameters. When you go to another stage, it also has a, as a corollary, you also have a change in your biochemistry of your brain when you push overreach. And then you start feeling more aggressive and you let the anger out and you feel more normal. And I noticed the symptoms, bang, went away like that.
Clear some of that junk out. You're a rock climber, right? You were referring to bouldering.
They have a gym that has bolt-on holds where you can climb all of these short problems above a padded room. So you can do them in sequence until you get really, really tired, which emulates the same situation as on a real climb where, you know, you have to do hundreds of feet.
And if I remember, you've got a couple of years behind you, too, for bouldering. That's right? Yeah, so you're kind of another example of not letting it slow you down.
All I notice is I'm getting better again. And
Stock Trader awesome. Mentions that you're a bungee jumper and a skydiver.
No, I'm not. I'm afraid of doing a thing like that. That relies too much on equipment. I like to rely on myself. I also noticed that taking off a few pounds makes a lot of difference, too. Everything gets easier.
Yeah.
5 or 10 pounds gone. So it's like activity builds on activity, and you're changing your brain at the same time, the neurochemistry. And that's pretty self-evident, I think. It's obvious that when you get in shape, but you see how TMS is keeping you always within these strictured parameters where you never overreach like that. You never extend your boundaries. And that's part of the fear, isn't it? You want to be cautious and protect yourself and so on. Cover, you know, protect your center. And that's because you're afraid of the future.
We're in this defensive crouch. And why wouldn't we? Because we've been so terrified by all of this. I mean, the body is falling apart. You can't trust your body. You're in pain all the time. It messes with your neurochemistry. Yeah.
Regarding the mind and the body and exercise, I recall a study I heard about where they studied the brain patterns of athletes. And they found that they had fewer thoughts, and that's, I'm saying, noise. They had less brain noise going on, and I would say that's jumping from one. They were able to, what I'm saying, focus. They were more focused on fewer thoughts, and they saw those thought patterns through. Usually athletes are thought of as dumb jocks, and I think... I've seen a lot of kids who were on team, played team sports and got straight A's, and I think the two come together somehow. They were able to organize their thinking, structure their lives, so that they were able to excel both in education and their sport. Where average students who weren't on a team got average grades and did average in physical things. So I think the excelling at the body, the two bring each other along, the mind and body, and improve the efficiency of both the mind and the body by doing activity, being active.
Yeah, I like this because it's kind of like the best defense is a good offense. That if you're afraid of the fear, you go out and TMS wants us to be negative. It wants us to think about what we've lost, and we instead think about what we've gained and what we still have left.
Alex, success breeds success. When you go out and do something successfully, you get confidence, and then you go out and want more success and do more of what makes you feel good, creating endorphins, the natural morphine of the body, which is probably better than the artificial morphine. I think endorphins are probably superior.
I would agree with that. Stock Trader says, while healing from TMS, it is important. I love what he writes. It's important not to try to heal. Just go about your daily life. Do things you want to do. Head in a new direction. Ease up on yourself. Let more go. Joy adds, feel the fear and do it anyway. Listen to what's inside of you. Quiet the mind. And we can see how exercise can kind of bring you into the zone, into this meditative state to help quiet all of those noises. I do want to say, so we've talked a lot about these various things. I do want to emphasize again that, you know, it is important to do the work, that journaling still helps. There's one note I wanted to add before the end of the session, and we are closing up, so I'm going to add this thought. In terms of doing the deep psychotherapeutic work, a lot of people think that what you do is you go and you look in the past, and then you use the past to understand what's happening in the present. So you say, I'm going to journal an awful lot, and then by journaling, I'm going to use that to decrease my current tension. That's kind of going from the past and focusing on the past and using that to understand the present. I think you can go the opposite direction. I think you can look at the present, understand your inner critic, your inner bully in the present, and then use that to understand the past. So you can notice that you are doing these three things, which Alan Gordon emphasizes. Causing yourself to feel fear, the catastrophizing that we've talked about in previous podcasts. You may be putting excess pressure on yourself. You may be being excessively critical of yourself. And then you can use that, so you start with these present behaviors, these present destructive behaviors, and then you go back into the present and you say, what are the origins? And then by understanding the origins, that may help you better to defend yourself from those behaviors. So Stock Trader mentioned that this would be mindfully. So you work on mindfully understanding your present, being aware of the emotions and the tension that you're generating in the present, and then you use that to understand the past. I'll bring up an example from my own experience. So as I look at those three destructive behaviors that Alan mentioned, I can relate to all of them. So the first one is fear. He talks about how us TMSers tend to terrify ourselves. I know I did. I used to, when I had TMS, I would always scare myself with my symptoms and how they got worse and how my freedom was limited. And what I was able to do afterwards is by focusing on that present behavior, I was able to tie that into the past and say, okay, well, my mother died when I was 9, and Bruce early on talked about how, you know, you have to look at childhood experience through the lens of how a child would see it, and of course that would be a terrifying thing for a child. So that's an example of, in the Alan Gordon program, recognizing a destructive behavior of terrifying myself, that my symptoms were never going to get better, and then identifying the source in childhood experience. Another example would be pressure or self-criticism. And in both of these things, you know, I can identify myself putting a lot of pressure on myself to, you know, do lots of stuff or being self-critical. And I do have a tendency of being self-critical as well. I go back and I can look and say, okay, where does this come from? And again, I can find the roots of that in childhood experience. I was raised by my father more or less, and fathers don't provide a lot of the supportive love and kind of non-self-critical love that a mother might. And so I can understand my history and my current state better, and be better able to protect myself from my own inner bully by looking at that stuff. So an awesome and amazing conversation about the present and how important it is to be aware of the present and aware of one's energy in the present. But I think it's also the key, I think, to TMS healing is balance, or one of the many keys to TMS healing is balance. So I thought I would tie in a little bit of the past today, since that's promised here, right? That's our subject of the day.
I think it's interesting how the conclusions we've reached about, just do it and live your life in the now, go completely are contradicted by the advice given by physicians and physical therapists to refrain from physical activity. You will never run again. Do not attempt to run. All the bend like this. Here's a way to stand so you can brush your teeth without aggravating your back. It's like everything they tell you, in fact, keeps you from getting to that space where you can heal yourself, because you're like living in fear constantly if you listen to them.
They turn us into cripples.
Yeah.
It had me bedridden. The doctors did that to me. Those words from those doctors had me laid up in that bed for nearly a year, and it blowed my mind. How was this happening to my body? I was 39 years old. What's going on? And it was because those words from the doctors was going over and over and over. And then I'd get on the internet and, talk about, it was terrible. And I was believing all that.
Yeah, there's a physical therapy shop I pass on the way to the climbing gym when I leave the parking lot. And right in the front of it, there's a 6-foot-high banner covered with different items of advice about proper posture and proper lifting, and don't do this and don't do that and don't do this and don't do that. And it's like 6 foot by 7 foot. And you can see someone who's been subjected to that day after day when they go into physical therapy, they're going to be like covering. They're going to be trying to avoid engaging in any of these kind of prohibited behaviors. And that seems like the cornerstone of this physical therapy place. They're looking for people who have carpal tunnel syndrome from working on a PC. And then they've got it's like a marketing niche.
Yeah. And talk about feeding the inner bully. Now, that will feed the inner bully any day. All these warnings that we're told not to bend this way, don't do that, don't do this. Talk about feeding the inner bully. That does it very well.
Yeah.
Yeah, the great nocebo effect. I got a theory about where that came from. I think in the good old days, we lived in small towns. Your doctor kind of saw you and he followed you through your life, and he was part of the community. Now you might see your doctor once a year, or maybe a different doctor every time on the assembly line medical system. And somehow they have a feeling this is their one shot at you, and they better give it their best shot, telling you, be careful, So I know my doctor. I'd seldom see him, but when I did, he told me, okay, quit running, because I've got all these. I used to be a marathon runner. He said, you're going to wind up like them with knee problems and hip problems if you don't quit doing all that crazy running. And I never had any hip pain at all when I was doing marathons. So I've refuted that. I didn't get my arthritis in my hip till much later, and I no way related to having done all that running. I related to somebody whose name I will not mention here tonight. But a relationship a relationship gone bad. That's what I relate to giving me my my hip, being a hippie now. Yeah. Not to running, but to a bad relationship.
Yeah. There you go. Good old thing, psychological.
Yeah.
Well, shall we end on that note? I think we've got that concept. Maybe next week. Does anyone have any final thoughts they want to share?
Nope.
All right. So next week, let's do sections. We've already done mindfulness, so let's jump ahead to address repression, that section 3.5, and identify the source of the repression. So previously we were talking about abuse, and now we're going to talk about repressing sadness and repressing anger. So that'll be the thing. Thanks everyone for joining us. I hope you survive this heat wave. Hope it isn't too crazy where you're living, and maybe we'll hear you next week.
Yeah, we're finally getting the fog coming through, at least in the Bay Area. It finally dropped.
Good to hear. Good to hear.
Yeah, it was up there at 100 for day after day after day.
Yeah, I think I've drank a gallon of tea and water since I've been sitting here. It got pretty hot in Georgia today.
I believe it did.
Especially being a roofer. But, hey, I had a great time, guys. This was awesome. This was awesome tonight.
Excellent.
Especially with all the stock trader, Tennis Tom, and Joy. God bless every one of you.
Thank you all for joining.
Thank you, Rob. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to jump in the pool now.
All right. Take care. Talk to you later.
Love your enthusiasm, brother. Yeah,
bye. Stock trader is stirring rumors in the chat room.
He's spreading rumors. Okay.
He says Eric is drinking beer, but don't believe it for a second.
Man. God bless you. Okay.
All right. Talk to y'all later.
Okay. Night. Good night. Bye bye.
Good night, Tennis Town. Good night, Stock.
Okay. Bye, Eric. Bruce. Okay. Bye bye.